Hello and welcome to the How the Fuck podcast. I'm your host Ben, and this week I had an extremely insightful and in-depth chat with Tom, the director of content at the Series A stage contract automation startup for lawyers Duro. We got to the heart of some of the biggest topics in conversation in the marketing world right now, like do you focus on brand or lead gen, inbound or sales, and gated or ungated content. But the main topic of this week's podcast is Tom's extraordinarily successful ebook building strategy. Using the techniques in the playbook we're about to discuss, Tom and his team get 1,200 plus organic downloads on their ebooks. They get the top minds of their industry to write for them for free, and they've built their entire company's inbound lead generation strategy off the back of it. If you subscribe, you'll have already received an email with a written playbook. And if you don't, head over to our website, link below this podcast, and subscribe on the link in this particular podcast article and you'll get sent it immediately. I hope you enjoyed the episode. Please message me if you did. I'd love to hear from you. So as director of Duro, what are your kind of priorities? What is your role?
So Duro is a post-Series A B2B SaaS company. So the journey we're on at the moment is trying to get from Series A to Series B. So there's certain revenue goals that we have to hit. We're still very small, it's 30 people in a couple of countries. So from my point of view is looking after content, the main thing I have to do is drive revenue growth. And we're quite unusual in having, number one, a director of content at such an early stage. I was actually employee number 12 as well. So really, number one, that's quite strange. And number two, we're also quite unusual in that the majority of our revenue is driven by inbound, which is quite weird for a B2B SaaS company at the early stage. Usually you get a bunch of sales development reps hammering the phones to get your initial traction because you don't have much of a brand to drive inbound, particularly in B2B, because it's hard to do splashy things with sexy software for lawyers to automate contracts. So inbound is a little bit unusual for as a kind of growth driver for a company of our stage, but that's what we do. And yeah, my job really is to do the content side of content marketing, obviously. But because we're an early stage company, there's a bunch of other things that I do as well. So I, broadly speaking, look after the brand from a kind of words point of view rather than from a visual point of view. We have an amazing design team who position us visually. And I also look after things like PR, SEO, which is a huge growth channel for us. And then also helping out with product copy as well, which is a really fun part of the job because we have a team made up of people with different kind of languages as their first language. So getting to finesse product copy is really fun. I really enjoy doing that. But yeah, very small, extremely hardworking marketing team.
It's so great that you're able to take that step to focus all on inbound. Like, I think it feels like quite a huge step. Like, how do you trust that you're going to get the inbound in the future by doing brand awareness activities right now, whilst also trying to accelerate? And especially for you being Series A, trying to get to that Series B stage, like, how do you trust that you're going to get to that, accelerate to that point and just focus on the brand awareness stuff right now? I think it's a really big step.
Yeah, it's a big gamble. And obviously we have an outbound team as well who are successful, but we're a bit earlier on the journey with outbound than we are with inbound. Especially the company had a few really big early wins in terms of clients that were extremely helpful from a kind of brand and positioning point of view. Like our first customer was Deliveroo and another early customer was Skyscanner, these kind of visionary tech companies taking a gamble on a brand new seed stage company was, I would say it was like good luck, but obviously a lot of work went into that. But yeah, that kind of helped and it gave us a bit of brand, like a crumb of brand to try and grow.
There's always this one or two visionary kind of people in companies like that who are willing to work with startups.
Yeah, for sure. And there's a reason why you target companies like that. People are more likely to gravitate to a company like that if they're of that mindset. But finding visionary early tech adopters in the in-house legal industry is perhaps not as easy as some other industries, with the greatest of respect to lawyers, but minimizing risk is their whole job. It's a bit more persuasion to be done.
Definitely. What made you make the decision, or what made the team make the decision about being more inbound focused? And what are the sort of levers you're pulling to allow that to happen inbound?
Yeah, I think the founders of the company definitely knew that they had an unusually good understanding of content as a driver of brand awareness, but also of traffic and growth. And I think early on, I was working with them as a freelancer before I joined the company and to help them with some kind of blog posts and stuff like that, ground zero stuff, an early stage company. And through pitching a strategy to them, it became clear that number one, obviously I had enthusiasm for what they were doing, but number two, there weren't a huge number of companies doing what I was suggesting that we do in terms of the tone and the volume and the positioning of our content. So there's definitely space for kind of content that would generate a conversation and interest and grow a little kind of mini brand in legal, which is what they decided to do. And it definitely worked quite well in the early years. So very grateful that they took a risk.
Yeah, that's so great. I guess like the founders being willing to take that risk is vital to being able to actually just give it a chance to work.
I think if I'd known, I'd never worked at a startup before I joined this one. So if I'd known how crucial the founder's mindset is to your job satisfaction, I probably would have vetted them more carefully. But as it turned out, I had absolutely nothing to worry about. But had they been less incredible, they're both great, it would have been more difficult to get content going, I think.
So we want to talk about the ebook, but I'm wondering, is that the thing that you sort of pitched at the beginning as the way of getting inbound leads?
It is actually, and it's, I don't want to admit that it was partly by accident, but when I was freelancing for them, I pitched the idea of this massive ebook because in part it would be very lucrative for me as a freelancer because I was charging by the word. And then they hired me to do it. So that kind of went away and I had to deliver this enormous project. But I think part of the reason why we did that was just being really honest was my background. My previous role was thought leadership at a couple of enterprises. So thought leadership in that kind of ebook sense was to an extent what I was comfortable doing. So it was an obvious thing to try and do. You lean into your strengths at an early stage company. And also knowing a bit, obviously I know a lot more now, but knowing a bit about the kind of audience we're going after, lawyers love written content. They love long form, chunky things that seem valuable to them and they'll give up their details for it. So in a really crude sense, it just seemed like something that would work. And I didn't really see anything out there that was covering the kind of territory that we wanted to do. So it seemed an obvious thing to write. It was one of those ideas where once we had it, it seemed so obvious that we wondered why no one else was doing it. Usually that makes you think probably someone is doing it, so we need to get ours out first. That's the kind of idea where it's definitely a good idea. If you have that kind of fear, we just started, just got on with it.
It found a gap in the market and it was like, oh my God, let's quickly get on this. And it worked.
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah, so the first one we did was, it's a new discipline in legal, and it's not new, but legal operations is a new thing in the context of the legal industry being hundreds of years old, which is having business-minded people in an in-house legal department to try and run it like a revenue-facing function and think about things like comms and budgeting and tech and processes the way every other function has to do, rather than being wizards who dispense legal advice, which is what lawyers historically have been. And there's an organization called CLOC, the Corporate Legal Operations Consortium, that kind of defined legal ops as being, it's these 12 things. So I pitched the idea of we should write a book which has 12 senior lawyers talking about each of these things. No one's done that, let's do it.
And is that the one that we're talking about, the 1,000 organic contacts? Was that the first one?
There's actually many, that one actually did a bit better in terms of organic content. So if you're in the UK and you search for legal operations right now, the top result on Google is us. And then if you click through, you'll end up downloading that ebook. That was the first thing we did. And then last year we did something a bit more aligned with our current ideal customer profile, which is lean legal teams at scale-up companies. So we wrote a book called Legal for Scale-Ups last year, which was a similar kind of idea. We came up with what we thought were kind of 10, 11, 12, I can't remember how many, crucial topics for legal teams to wrestle with at that kind of company very specifically. And then we went and found general counsel or CLOs of really successful tech companies to write it for us. And we pitched it and got them on board and then they wrote it for us.
How do you come up with the idea for the topic? If you had to start there.
Yeah, I guess there's two different answers to that. The kind of good one, the well-behaved one, I should say, is I'm an enormous believer in doing customer research. I think like spending time with your current and future customers and people who perhaps didn't buy, like lost prospects, is pretty much the most valuable thing you can do in almost any role in a startup. And what I do in like every couple of weeks really is do quite deep discovery with our ideal customers. So not just do you use LinkedIn or do you use Facebook or whatever, but what time did you start work today? What are the things you have open on your browser? What was the last thing your manager did in your one-to-one that really annoyed you? What are the things that you want to talk about in your one-to-one but you don't get to? Who are the other teams in the company that hate you? Like when you feel underappreciated, why is that? You're really trying to get to what makes them happy and sad at work and what they spend their time doing. And usually out of that, you'll come up with substance that will resonate with them. That's part one. But part two is something that resonates with them is not necessarily something newsy enough to get clicked. So there's also definitely a certain pithiness. That word was pithiness you need to have, which was Legal for scale-ups is three words. That's very pithy, but it immediately tells people who look at the cover of that ebook, I work in legal and I'm at a scale-up, this is for me. Yeah. You need something that seductive and simple to get people through the door. So that's really how we try to come up with ideas. Like the other thing you need to think about when you come in with an idea for a big content project, not just a blog that's going to come and go in a day, but something you have to invest months in, is, and this has comes to the whole heart of the should you gate content debate, really, is if you imagine a matrix, like with ideal customer profile being one of the quadrants and pain that our product solves being the other line, it's pretty hard to do something that will solve both of those and get lots of people to read it. So if we were to write a book about how GCs small teams at fast growth tech companies can automate MSA contracts in browser, which is what Jira does. Like all the leads will be relevant, but there'll be about 50 of them. So you need to pick something. You either need to go big on the pain or big on the ideal customer profile. Mm. And with that book, Illegal for Scale-Ups, obviously there's no guarantee that if someone's a lawyer at a scale-up, they need contracts software right now. Like they might hit all of our criteria, but they're good. They're either in contract with someone else that they're happy with, or they found a different way to solve it or whatever. And if we talk about contract automation, again, like it'll be really high relevance, but it'll be quite low numbers. So what we try to do is just become best friends with our ideal customers, put ourselves at the center of their lives. And we've had better results commissioning, I guess you would say, for persona fit than we have for product pain, because you don't download ebooks when you've got like a software problem.
Yeah. I guess we're actually having this exact sort of debate, because the last ebook I did was very much like, oh, it's not that related to us, but it's very related to exactly that ideal customer. But there wasn't much about us. So it's when we call them up after that ebook, which we try doing, they're just like, oh.
Yeah, it's a very common problem, actually. And in optimizing for customer persona rather than pain, you are slightly pushing a problem or a bit of work to your sales team. You need a really skilled sales team and like MDRs as opposed to SDRs to be able to call up and convince someone who is your perfect customer but doesn't know that they need your product to take a sales meeting. That's really difficult. It's much harder than someone who's requested a demo or whatever. So it's definitely a balancing act, and it doesn't always work. Like often it's very gratifying for me in a short-term sense, but often we'll call people up as a result of an ebook and they'll be like, oh, great content. Loved it. Like, we don't need anything like the thing that you're selling, but I love the book. Like, well done. Thanks very much.
The key is that person also knew what you did. Like, they'd gone, who is this company, and looked at what you did and decided they don't need it at the moment. But maybe one day they will need that.
Oh, exactly. Now we have them in our database and we can push them more content. We can invite them into our community. There's all kinds of things we can do. Yeah. But you need to give them some value to get them in the door in the first place. And this is one way of doing that. By no means the only way, but definitely a good way.
When people download the ebook, do you have a button that's, do you want to join our newsletter, or do they fall into a sales cadence, which is just like sharing valuable content into the future?
We've been through lots of different versions of that. So I think if it was an enterprise company, if you download an ebook from Salesforce or whatever, there probably won't really be any humans doing any of it. You're going to go into a system and your activity is going to drive a lead score and serve you a very sophisticated cadence based on what you do, and then at some point you'll either request a demo or maybe you'll get a call if you raise your hand enough. I think for an early stage company, you've got to get the balance right, because on the one hand, someone downloading a book about how to survive as the first lawyer in a high growth company is good, but there's absolutely no sign there that they have anything, any indication that they need your product. So there's definitely a gamble there. But if someone comes in and downloads some thought leadership content that's quite top of funnel, but they work for a company that does the exact same thing that one of your current customers does, then it's quite likely that they might have the same problem. And if you can get on the phone with them, then you might be able to shortcut that whole sophisticated nurture process and then get them to take a sales meeting.
So it's still worth like the sales team to call them and try it?
Yeah, it's horses for courses. It depends on how the company works. Like, we've had quite good success with converting content downloads into customers, but like, it's too early to say whether that's because of the kind of company we are, because of the content, because of the particular sales reps we have and what they're naturally good at or not good at. And it's very rare that you could just say this will definitely work and this is the thing that you should do. So what works for us might not work for other vendors, and definitely doesn't work for some other vendors.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Do you have a Slack community or anything like that that you like invite them in?
Yeah, the quickest way to build up our newsletter list is obviously to get people to opt in when they download content, and that tends to be where we see the biggest spikes in our opt-ins. But last year we launched a private community for basically perfect customers and existing customers, which has been an enormous amount of work, but I would say it's been extraordinarily successful. So I really wish we'd done it like a year ago, but it eats half of my life. But it's really rewarding. Like, we set up and you just see, you know, perfect customer A talking to perfect customer B about parenting in lockdown and stuff, and you realize that you've actually built something valuable for these people. It's really good. And then there's just not any chance you won't be front of mind if they ever decide to buy the thing that you sell. So it's really good, but it's a lot of work. Build a community at peril, because it needs to be really good for people to stick around.
Mm-hmm. That's a great idea, just to have the go-to person for an ideal customer to ask about software is your customer. Okay, cool. I wanted to go back to, we talked a little bit about how you decided on a subject. Do you work like SEO into that, and like the current target customer into that? Like you said, like scale-ups. Okay, we want to go for them now, or is it just...
I'd say yes, and I think it depends. If it's gated content, then SEO doesn't really matter anyway, because you put most of the value behind the gate. So you're making a choice not to go down the SEO route there, unless you can find a way to optimize your page to rank and then get people through the gate that way, which you can do. But I think if what you want is extreme kind of value for a very specific set of people, it's seductive, but probably a mistake to try and cram it through the lens of SEO, because it's just like too unlikely that there'll be a keyword that's easy enough to get, but still has significant volume that works for your value proposition and what you're trying to sell, and sounds interesting to the people trying to buy, and is good content. It's like a lot of boxes to tick. And you can do it with some really broad phrases, like legal operations, for example, with that book, where you repurpose some of the book into a page which now ranks. But you probably want to do that afterwards, because like the purpose of gating content is to get a load of leads quickly.
Yeah.
And then in perpetuity. But SEO is not really going to factor into how you launch that content, because by definition, it's going to take a while to rank. So you should definitely use it for keyword-driven content later, once it's used some of its lifetime up. But in the first instance, it wasn't really a consideration.
So if we take away the fact that the content itself is valuable, what's then the key, would you say, to making it go far, like to get any leads?
This is like not a word that usually has a good connotation, but it's cheat. So I'm a big advocate of using thought leaders from other companies in your content. And it's not just because it's cool to talk to the general counsel of a Premier League football club or whatever. It's because their brands are better than yours, and you need to be happy with that. If you're an early stage company, it's a really important realization to know that no one gives a, I was about to swear, no one cares what you think at all. Like you don't, almost no one in the world has heard of you. So if I turned around tomorrow and was like, Juro has written a book about how to grow a legal team, or I did that 2 years ago before we had any brand, no one would care. And why would they? We don't, who are we? We don't know anything. I'm like a marketer. I'm not a lawyer. So the quickest shortcut to credibility and authority, which is what makes people want to download, as well as having sexy brands, is just cheat. Just borrow other people's brands.
Yeah.
Like a book from Juro about legal operations isn't interesting, but a book put together by Juro featuring Monzo, Microsoft, and all these other companies is now interesting, because they're good brands. People have heard of them.
Yeah.
So just cheat and get better brands to front your content, and then it's like a shortcut to credibility.
So what does that...
Easy said than done there.
Yeah, but it's a similar method to doing a podcast like this. Like I get bigger, the bigger the person I get on here, the more listens that episode gets.
Yeah.
Are you selecting people who are like mini, like influencers, or do they just have to have credibility, or do you actually select... Do you work with the brand, like you said, Monzo, you work with the brand themselves and say, can we use your email list? And send it out to that as well.
I've never done that, mainly because the chance of Monzo saying, yes, you can market to our list for free is zero. And also it wouldn't be compliant. But I think in terms of how you get people on board, it's a bit like sales. If you need 5 people in the book, you're going to probably have to approach 50. So don't be shy, because most people ignore you. Like, and that's fine. I ignore people all the time. You need to be comfortable with that. And also like sales, you should go for the soft options first. So if you have warm intros to people who would be good, just do that. Just get them on board first. The other thing I would say is just ask. Don't agonize over a list for ages and be like, oh, what will happen here? Oh, these people definitely say no. There's no point talking to them. Just contact them, because some people will say yes immediately. And you'll be really surprised that they just took a cold approach through a LinkedIn message from someone they've never heard of. But it's flattering if you're saying to them, we're putting together a book on X subject and we think you are one of the world experts. Will you be in the book? And I mean, we can talk about process. You also need to make it really clear to them that the time commitment from them is very little. You're going to do almost all the work. They're going to get to read the copy before like you publish it and sign it off. What's the downside? They give up half an hour of time and it's going to make them seem like an amazing thought leader and you're going to do all the work. So yeah, that's what we do.
And that's, do you always, because I downloaded one of your ebooks and it's like each chapter is as if it's written by one person. Is that how you always do it? Or do you ghostwrite for them after an interview, or how does that work?
Pretty much, yeah. I think almost by definition, particularly if the people that you're trying to feature are not, like the industry's not writing, lawyers are not great writers because they're not writers. There are some of them that are really good at blogging or whatever, but most of them have their own channels and they're not really interested in promoting yours. So most of the chapters in our ebooks were produced by us interviewing them and then ghostwriting into first person, mm-hmm. which does take a lot of work and stuff. One very fortunate skill that I have, which is a complete accident of history, is the first job I had involved interviewing lawyers for a directory and it was all live transcription. So I got really good at doing interviews in real time whilst transcribing it. And then the notes afterwards are pretty much there, which saves you, I don't know if you ever transcribed an interview, but it saves you like days. So that's a really good skill to have if you can bash it out in real time. And the other thing is, like, this isn't the New York Times. It's okay if you've taken a bit of artistic license and crafted a point they made into a much better piece of prose. You don't need to nail every word because they didn't record it anyway. They're not going to listen back to it and say, hang on, that's not how I phrased it. Let's put it back to the boring way that I said it. I would say the level of editing and, well, let me put it a different way, the number of, the percentage of kind of chapters that I've written for ebooks, which has been aggressively edited by the person I ghost wrote it for, 3% maybe. No one cares. They get it back and they're like, wow, this is great. You're right. I am a genius. I should be in this book. Yeah. And it's their insights and your writing skill and everyone's happy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think as long as you make them sound better than they would have sounded anyway, not worse, they'll be happy.
Yeah.
So I guess you write it, you send it to them, they approve it, you then ask them to share it. I mean, you naturally might want to share that kind of thing, but.
Yeah, so this is like secret sauce. So it depends how much time you have to put it together. So obviously you want good brands and you want people who have, like, who actually know what they're talking about. There's no point getting someone who works at an impressive company but doesn't know anything. But if you really want to make this work, like, to an unfair level, you can pre-vet your contributors for their reach. And that doesn't necessarily mean they work for companies that have 100,000 LinkedIn followers. You need to get a feel for how comfortable they are with self-promotion. And some people are and some people aren't. And some people will only be comfortable if others come with them. They're never going to post a thing and be like, look, aren't I amazing? But with scale-ups that we did last year and that ebook, we worked quite hard to bring together like lawyers from really great scale-ups, really interesting companies like TransferWise, GoCardless, Intercom. And then when you position it as like, there is now an authoritative text about X subject and you are the people in it, can you all share it? And you tag them. The reflected glory for that group is enormous. That if you pick someone, let's say who's at the lower end of that author list in terms of how big their companies are, they're looking at that list and being like, you're right, I am like Intercom. Like, yeah. We're just as impressive a brand. I belong in this list with everyone else. And you get them all sharing each other's posts and stuff. And that was a real kind of magic thing with Legal for Scalers, which is how we added so many. I think we added like 1,200 contacts to the database in a week or two. And we increased the LinkedIn following of the company by 30% in a month. And it was just because it went off on social. All the scale-up lawyers were like, oh, I need this. So I'm going to download it. Like I work at scale-up. One thing that was also quite smart that we did was there's a private practice lawyer. So we only sell to in-house legal teams. Law firms are always interested in legal tech, but we can't help them. They have different needs. Mm-hmm. But we got a lawyer, most of whose clients are the exact people we'd want to sell to introduce the book. And then that meant he would share it with his audience, who are all people we want in our database.
Yeah. Wow.
And then they all downloaded it. Mm-hmm. So you can be tactical there. If you're going to rely on social as like not just one off, but perhaps your main distribution channel, you need to think a bit beyond just let's post it and see what happens. Like, you need to de-risk the idea that no one's going to read it. Be good enough friends with these people that you can email them and be like, can you share? Can you say this? Can you use this hashtag? Can you tag this person? And if you've given them a pleasant enough experience working with them and made them seem like a genius, they'll probably do it for you.
Though I think the one thing, I think the genius is in those like tactics, like how you piece it together and who you choose. We had in the podcast, sorry, in the ebook that I did, we actually did it after the fact. So we actually just did 10 episodes of a podcast, and then I collated the insights from those people into chapters of books, but not like a whole chapter, but like a chapter on this subject, five people kind of comment. And it's just from the podcasts. And then I sent it to them afterwards. Do you mind being in this ebook? But it did mean that most of them, especially the big ones, didn't share it because I guess they were just like, well, I don't mind being in your ebook, but this was not necessarily the plan. So it's not like...
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, you have to set expectations beforehand. The other thing is, particularly with B2B stuff, so if you work for a really big B2C brand and there's a huge audience, you can put something out on social and see what happens and hope that people pick it up and all the rest of it. Don't take any chances with B2B. The audience is too small anyway. If you just put it out there and hope something good will happen, it won't. Just make it happen. DM all your friends and be like, I'm just about to post this. And the number of likes it gets in the first 5 minutes is going to determine what happens in the algorithm. Just get that link, send it to your WhatsApp groups. It doesn't really matter who pushes it up in the algorithm at first, but like it needs some traction before it gets most of its traction. So just anything you can do to have a structured launch plan, even if it's seemingly organic, is just going to make it more likely you're going to succeed.
It's like the behind the scenes of things that do really well, isn't it? You don't see.
So all the... Yeah, just like try really, really hard.
Would you send something like that out to, I guess, all your existing mailing list as well? Do you think that helped in that organic, like in the downloads?
Yeah, but by definition, there's not a huge amount of value in reconverting your existing list, but it does help nurture them.
Yeah, sure.
So it does help you clean your database as well, because your data is aging all the time and your contacts are just moving to other companies and destroying the value of your contact list. So it's definitely worthwhile. And also, if you've produced something that's really valuable that you're actually proud of, definitely share it with them.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Yeah, that's a good idea. Do you, out of interest, do you get freelancers to help write, or do you write all like this kind of big content in-house? Like,
I'm going to kind of phrase this quite delicately. I've never really worked with a freelance writer who could do what we do to the same standard. And I don't mean they're bad writers. I understand the exact brand positioning that we're trying to express in a time frame that made it worthwhile to get them to do it instead of us doing it. I think if we didn't have a content team, I definitely would, or if I found the right writers. But there are other things I outsource, by the way. I don't mean to just crap on freelancers or anything like that. There's great ones out there. We outsource a bunch of other stuff. So the layout of the PDF and the graphic design and all that kind of stuff, we do outsource, and like copy editing, proofreading. But the writing we tend to do in-house. But that's to do with the makeup of the team more than anything else.
Mm-hmm. It's really hard to, especially if you like just met them, to be like, please care as much as I do about our customer and what, and really try to understand what we do.
Yeah, it's just unrealistic as well. It's not feasible that someone could get inside the head of your ideal customer in a one-page brief and then deliver against it. And if they could, they'd probably be charging far too much for you to be able to afford to do them, to use them anyway.
So you said about weaving in the brand positioning into these kind of things. So what does that look like? How do you do that?
Yeah, that's quite a delicate balance. I think, like, firstly, you can't get the thought leaders that don't work at the company talking about ramming your brand messaging down people's throats. Just, they would take it out anyway when they read the copy. But it's more about how you frame the whole piece of work, like what's on there. Like Scaleups, for example, is very much about positioning the company as being a company that understands the pain points of legal teams at Scaleups. Mm-hmm. And in the introduction to the book, which was written by the CEO, we talked about the Scaleups that we work with, some of whom are in the book, kind of thing. And obviously you're trying to let them shine, but you are subtly and not so subtly reinforcing the idea that these people are the exact people that we work with. So if you're one of these people, you should probably think about working with us. And we never make it that explicit, but you know, the association of our brand and our kind of people next to the general counsel of a bunch of tech scale-ups is just good. It just like subliminal advertising when you see Kazu on a football shirt. It's just like, now you associate Kazu with Everton and Villa, and the transformation of Everton into a smooth continental team under Carlo Ancelotti. And it's the same thing. You just put yourself next to brands and people that you want to be associated with.
Yeah. And ideally, bigger and better ones. I've heard the advice before, just tell them that you'll do all the work. and also Data One. Like, I've got Monzo on board. Transfer-wise, you should also come on board.
For sure, yeah. Once you get a few early people on, you can definitely use them to convince others, especially if you know that they know each other, because the scale-up legal is quite, it's not a small world, but there's lots of people who used to train at the same law firm, or they went to the same law school, or and you can see they're connected on LinkedIn, and like, oh, they used to work at Lloyd's together 10 years ago. And it is a good proof point. If it's, you never have to be as explicit about it, but if you say to General Counsel A, oh, General Counsel B is going to be in it as well, and they know each other, yeah, then it's just a bit of social proof where they're like, oh, these guys must be for real. I'll take the call.
Yeah, definitely. I think if they can, that's another kind of type of, or version of that, I guess, is like being able to look through your old ebooks. Like, now you've got a few, they can know like it's really high production quality and the writing's good and you've got good people. And
yeah, for sure. We're actually working on something at the moment, and exactly that. Like, when I was contacting people who don't know that I want to be in it, who have very lofty ambitions, I just made sure that we sent them this previous thing. It's like, we're producing some content. The reason you should care is it's going to be spectacular like this one, so you're going to want to be in it. And it just helps to establish that what you're doing is credible, because it's still, even at this point, almost no one in the world has heard of us. Just getting the endorsement of, like, you should be in some content of ours because these 12 GCs have been as well, is a lot easier than you should be in our content because we're really nice people. Yeah. Trust them. You don't need to trust us.
Would you always get the, I guess, the kind of budget holder of your ideal customer persona? Is that the person that you want to be writing the content?
It depends. Commercial strategy question, I guess. It depends who we want as leads. We are targeting economic buyers, and the economic buyer of our product is usually the general counsel. Sometimes CFO or ops might be involved in the decision, but the main person we would need to convince, and the main kind of owner of the project of implementing our product, would be a general counsel or a head of legal. So yeah, as long as that's the case, they're the people that we focus on.
Yeah, cool. That makes sense. I think I'm not sure what other questions I've got for you. Is there anything that I should ask that I haven't asked, do you think?
Think about what I thought about before this meeting. I guess the only thing I haven't really covered is the question of, should you gate content at all? Which is definitely the subject of a lot of vacuous thought leadership on LinkedIn at the moment. And like, the honest answer is, it depends. Like, I'm quite pro gated content because it's worked really well for us, but it doesn't mean it's going to work for everyone. But the point I saw Alice from Cognizant make on LinkedIn the other day is that you shouldn't junk a project because it's not working, because it might mean that you're not doing it very well. And that's true for ebooks, as it's true for everything. Like, the idea is that you shouldn't gate content because you want more people to see it, and by gating it, you're putting people off and increasing, like, you know, the maximum number of eyes is going to give you the maximum number of leads. But in our experience, which again is very unique to us, but in our experience, if you give people something good enough, they'll give you their details. And if they don't want to give you their details, maybe it wasn't good enough. And that's like quite a harsh way of looking at it, but we have a very specific kind of market sector for whom we can deliver success with the product, and some communities are too big. And I've had to qualify out leads from content downloads like Google and Apple, because we can't sell to that kind of company. But it shows you that, like, people will give up their details. If the general counsel of Apple is happy to give me their email for some content, then I don't think gated content is dead. But it doesn't mean that it's going to work for every sector. Like, some products just need bums on seats. They just need 1,000 people a day to come to the website, or 10,000 people, whatever. But we found that if you, like, an enormous amount of things have to go, but if the content's good enough, you'll get what you want from the gate. But yeah, search is a whole different thing, which you can have a different podcast about.
My sort of understanding of not gating things is that you get like the brand awareness, but you just have to trust that at some point they will come back, and you don't have to call them actively.
Yeah, and it depends. Like, there are products that kind of are ungated content formats, but have a level of data capture and tracking that a PDF doesn't. And PDFs are pretty crude. There's no getting around that. If someone downloads a PDF, there's nothing to stop them from sending it to their mate, and you never knowing about it. But in that case, it's actually the same outcome, because, okay, you don't know that they've read it, but you don't know that someone who didn't go through the gate read it either. You know, you have to be comfortable with people passing your content around. Ultimately, that's what you want. You want more people to be exposed to the brand. But it's horses for courses. You need to test it. Some things work through a gate and some things just don't at all.
You say, like, if it's something's valuable enough, people will download it. How do you get people to realize that value before downloading it?
The quickest shortcut is having, again, like cheating and having great brands front it. If I were to publish an ebook tomorrow, which was the CEOs or like revenue leaders of, I don't know, Zoom, Peloton, Deliveroo, talking about like how they pivoted during the crisis. And the promise was that each of them had laid out their commercial strategy for 2,000 words, I'd have no problem getting people to go through the gate. But if I just put something out that with, I don't want to actually name any brands as not being good, but without impressive brands, it's just a harder sell. If it was just like Juro's advice on how to react to the pandemic, it's less compelling than companies that did it really well. And you need to work out early how easy it's going to be to use those brands as well, because even if you get loads of impressive brands on board, you're not going to get permission to put their logos on the front of your ebooks. It's just not going to happen. But it is a matter of record that they work for those companies. So if you ever find yourself really early on in that process encountering the brand team, it's either not worth it or it's really worth it, because then they're going to promote it. But generally, that's something of a red flag. If someone you're approaching is like, at this very early stage, I need to involve my brand team, it's just probably going to slow you down. And they're probably going to like take the copy and make it anodyne and all that kind of stuff. And like, life's too short. Like every now and then you might want to like cling on and try and get someone in the book because their reach is so big that it's going to be worth it to have worked with them in this slightly painful way. We do put disclaimers in the front of the book. These views are not those of the employers of these people nor those of Juro kind of thing, but they're distant, so it's clear that they're talking from their own experiences rather than laying out some kind of brand position. You don't have to worry about that with lawyers, they'll make that very clear.
Is there like how long is your typical ebook, like how many pages?
It depends. So the Legal Ops ebook was absolutely massive because I was trying to pitch it to make a load of money as a freelancer. So it's like where we printed 70 pages or something crazy. And Legal for Scale-Ups is really big as well. The shorter ones we've done are sort of 20 pages, maybe 30 pages. It depends how long you have to do it as well, because another reason why gated content is less fashionable in a startup, let's say, is that it takes ages. To produce something really good takes a long time. And it's quite hard to say to your CEO or whoever's your manager, for the next 8 weeks I'm going to be doing something that delivers no value. Try getting away with that. We do have like some impressive ebooks we've only produced in 2 weeks, but that was a result of doing nothing else and working like absolute animals. But you need to be prepared to make the case that this isn't going to be a quick victory, but it's going to be a huge victory when it does happen. But you got to think that through.
Cool. You're giving me a lot to think about. Thank you very much. I really appreciate having you on the podcast.
No worries. It's been a lot of fun. And yeah, if you have any questions or anyone listening has any questions, I can't imagine that they would because I've said a lot of stuff. But happy to get in touch on LinkedIn or whatever and see if I can help.